This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A pro-Trump mob stormed the U.S. Capitol on Wednesday ahead of the congressional acceptance of the Electoral College vote affirming the election of Joe Biden as the next president. President Trump, who was defeated by 7 million popular votes and 74 electoral votes, had incorrectly and unsubstantially, since November, claimed the election was stolen and fraudulent, and ahead of the insurrection on the steps of the nation's capital addressed those same people. Now members of Congress are calling for the vice president and the U.S. cabinet to invoke the 25th Amendment and remove Trump from office now, 12 days before he's set to leave by constitutional obligation. So let's talk about what went down on Wednesday and what's going on now with Washington Post Capitol Hill reporter Rhonda Colvin. She joins us on Zoom. Rhonda, welcome back to our show.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
It's our pleasure to have you again. You were there on Wednesday when all of this was going down, covering the events for The Washington Post. Why don't you tell our listeners what the experience was like from your vantage point?
Yes, I was there all day Wednesday. I started off there early in the morning to cover the beginning of the certification vote to finalize the 2020 election. So we knew it would be a long day because Republicans had said they wanted to object to some of the electoral vote counts. So I was there around 10 a.m. Around 1 p.m., this was about 1:15, I would say, we were told in the area I was with other media that we needed to evacuate the Cannon House building. That's where we were, and that we needed to go to the basement level. So myself and a camera woman went down to the basement level, stayed there for about an hour, and then we sort of learned that things were escalating we had some conversations with police officers who were telling us that things were escalating and to keep going further down into the basement, further away from the Capitol, and to seek shelter. So I was at the point of when the woman we now know, a young woman who was killed when she tried to enter the House chamber, I was with a police officer and I could hear on his radio, shots fired, shots fired. So at that point, he told me and three other journalists to find shelter and find a room where we could lock ourselves in until we were given an all clear. So I spent most of my afternoon in a basement electrical closet. We barricaded the door and we watched the scenes unfold that were happening on the outside and how people were trying to get in.
What was going on in your mind as you were barricading a door inside the U.S. Capitol?
I kind of kept composure because I was also on the air. I was live reporting with the Washington Post. We have a live show. We had a live show going on at the time. And so I wanted to make sure that people heard the updates as I heard them. I was right next to officers as they heard that there were shots fired. So I was trying to give reporting in real time so that people could understand what it was like to be inside that building when there was so much chaos. We didn't know which way people were coming, how many of them there were. So I just stayed on the line with our producers and our anchor trying to detail what we were experiencing. But I have to say that I knew that it would be a tense day because of these objections planned. And being on the Hill routinely, daily, usually before COVID, there have been many, many tense moments, of course. And I feel that the events that transpired on Wednesday were just sort of, just a part of a slow track that had begun building for a while, actually. I certainly could not have told the future and knew what would happen. But I mean, we knew there was a situation. We knew a day ahead of time that we at the Washington Post had reported that there were some of the dark websites were seeing chatter of people wanting to bring guns into D.C. for this standoff. So we did know there was a level of concern that would be happening in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday. We didn't know the scale, of course.
It looks like in the aftermath of the violence that transpired at the Capitol that the events of the day changed course. There were multiple lawmakers in both chambers, the Senate and the House, who had planned to sign on to these objections to certifying the results of the Electoral College vote submitted by the states to the Congress. This is just a constitutional procedure that usually goes without any sort of incident. But what can you tell us about how this violence changed the minds of some members of the Senate, most notably Kelly Loeffler, who was running for re-election in a special election that same week, this week, lost, and then changed her mind?
That's right. It did sort of change the temperature when they returned to the chamber to go back to the business they started. And you're right, Kelly Loeffler, after the events transpired, she announced that she no longer had a plan to object. She was supposed to object to Georgia's electoral vote tally when it was announced, and she said she wasn't. And there were others who reconsidered, too. So it did sort of deflate these actions that we had planned to see from Republicans, but they did continue on with the day, and we did see objections to Pennsylvania. Josh Hawley said he, even after all that happened, he wanted to continue to object to Pennsylvania's electoral votes, and he did. And as we had been reporting for weeks now, all of those efforts failed because that January 6th process is not built for you to change an election. It's not built for you to overturn an election. It's constitutionally scripted out. So these efforts were just basically slowdown measures. And that's exactly what happened. And then early Thursday morning, they ended things and finally certified Joe Biden as the next president.
We're talking with Washington Post reporter Rhonda Colvin. She joins us live via Zoom. You are intimately familiar with the proceedings at the Capitol and the way the operations work there. And so when I see a press release from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, soon to be Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, saying that he asked for and received the resignation of the Senate Sergeant at Arms. We're seeing the Capitol Police Chief resign. What do these sort of things mean exactly?
To me, I think the riot became very personal for these members of Congress. They were in a lot of danger, and you also have to remember that we had basically the whole continuity of government in that one building on Wednesday. So you had the vice president there, you had the Speaker of the House, you also had the president pro tem of the Senate, Chuck Grassley, who was also in line to be president if anything were to happen to the president. So you had, you know, major government officials there on the Hill all at the same time, and the Hill's being invaded, basically. So I think a lot of lawmakers are seeing this as that moment that they've got to speak up. For the last 4 years, I know I've been on the Hill and talked to Republicans many times when President Trump has said things that are controversial or, you know, away from, you know, constitutional law. And many times they have been hesitant to say anything explicit against him. I am seeing a little bit of tone change here. I'm not sure. I think we're still waiting and watching to see if it's permanent tone change. But you're right. This event did cause a lot of people who were allies of the president to speak up and say, we've got to do something. And yes, you've had Mitch McConnell say that. You've also had Nancy Pelosi not long ago say she's put in a call to the chair of the Joint Chief of Staff. And he said that she told him that she wants him to do something because President Trump is probably more dangerous than ever in the next few days before Joe Biden is sworn in. And he's got those nuclear codes. So she's looking at it from a military standpoint that something needs to be done. So to me, it seems like a lot of members on the Hill are looking at all sorts of avenues that they can take in order to ensure safety for the next few days.
I'm looking at the headlines on the Washington Post right now, and it does say Pelosi says she spoke to nation's top military leader about ensuring Trump doesn't launch a nuclear attack. I also note that there's a headline that is corroborated by a tweet from the president himself. Trump says he'll skip the inauguration. And that's pretty well unprecedented as well. This is a symbol of the way America transitions its leadership. And you see one president hand off the reins to the other. We're not going to have that image this time around. Are you hearing anything about the impact of that? Is that maybe for the best in some people's view?
That Trump isn't going to be there? Or
yeah.
You know, I think that is sort of like a... Honestly, it may be like the third or fourth tier story today that he finally has announced that he is not going to come. I think we knew, although it had not been confirmed, that he would not attend the inauguration. He just now yesterday gave probably one of his the closest moments where he has given some sort of concession, saying that he is interested now in the peaceful transition of power. But I think people now are really thinking about security. I was on the Hill yesterday. to look at, you know, kind of the aftermath, to do some interviews, and the National Guard is stationed all around the perimeter. There's a wall up now on the lawn where you would usually could go and walk on the lawn and toward the Capitol. I've been there many times where people are just jogging or taking a walk with their kids up there. That's now all walled off. So I think, yes, the president has officially said he's not going to attend, but I think really the story right now is, how are we going to stay safe for the next few days?
We've got 12 days left before Joe Biden becomes president, and we are hearing calls for a second attempt to impeach the president. We're hearing calls for the vice president and members of the cabinet to invoke the 25th Amendment, which they would have the authority to remove the president from office. How serious are these efforts?
You know, I would say they're pretty serious, and because you now have some of the Republican senators saying they are going to consider these avenues to remove Trump from power for the next few days. The numbers are growing, and I just by looking and listening to some of the lawmakers on the Hill. In fact, I spoke to one yesterday, and she was a representative from Pennsylvania. She was in a picture that's probably gone viral now where she was kind of trapped in the House gallery, and she looks very distressed. And Jason Crow, who was a combat veteran and a colleague of hers, is holding her hand. She told me about that ordeal, and she said, one of the reasons that I want to keep talking about this is because I don't want this situation to be normalized. I don't want us to move on to another news story and forget this. We can't do it from a national security perspective, and we just can't do it as American citizens to just let this, you know, be over in a couple days. And I think that's sort of the mood on the Hill right now, is they can't let this just, you know, just be another news story, another incident, and we move on. I think they're all looking at really serious efforts right now, and all the tools they have as a legislative branch to figure out a way to remove and at least remove some of his powers at the very least. Before Joe Biden is officially sworn in.
What should we be looking for in Washington in the coming days?
Well, I think there's also a mood of, is there going to be another situation like this? You know, I don't live far from Capitol Hill, and there's a heavy police presence all over the place here. But we do know many of the rioters, they were here staying at hotels. We don't know, is everyone gone? Are they planning to come back? There's still a lot of unknown right now. So I think a lot of people are just, you know, waiting and watching to see, could this happen again in the next few days, or even at the inauguration? We're waiting for at least some sense from the inaugural committees and the planning committees on the Hill to tell us about any additional security measures that will be taken for the inauguration. So I think we're all just kind of looking at these next steps.
We saw some pretty high-profile departures from the administration in the aftermath of the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, including Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao, the wife of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. We saw Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, other members of the administration depart. Any rumblings about others who might follow on their way out ahead of January 20?
Yeah, there are some sources saying that internally among aides at the White House that you might see a few more resignations. I know a lot of people who have been allies of the president, even allies on the Hill, have seen the events on Wednesday and say that they need to, you know, call these things out right now and decry the situation that happened there. I could guess that you will see some more resignations. I don't know how high level they will be, because the two that you just mentioned, those were pretty high. Those are cabinet officers. But we are hearing that there is still discussion among, you know, staffers and advisors around the White House that they may try to distance themselves from him and you know, leave early.
Well, I suppose if there are fewer members of the cabinet, it makes invoking the 25th Amendment a little more challenging. I'm wondering about the impeachment proceedings, should there be any. What happens procedurally with that? We watched it unfold over several months from 2019 into 2020. What should we be looking for as it relates to that this time around?
Right. So you do have members of the Judiciary Committee in the House, and that's where one of the committees where the last impeachment proceedings started. that they are trying to draft up the first steps of an impeachment. We're hearing from some House Democrats. I believe they just had a call actually earlier today to figure out what that strategy looks like. The impeachment involves a lot of steps. And as you mentioned, that's a great point. It was over the course of September 2019, after the Ukraine call surfaced, all the way through until February 2020. There are many procedural things that must take place, but I believe the House Democrats are looking at how they can expedite that process. They appear to be serious, although I don't know what the odds are that it could happen so quickly. Because it also has to go, once the House gets done with it, it also has to go to the Senate for a vote. Now, you know, part of the news on Wednesday is that the Senate now has turned over to Democratic control. It's now a 50-50 Senate, but we don't have those two Democratic senators from Georgia sworn in yet. So if an impeachment proceeding could get successfully through the Senate, you're going to need Republicans now to vote and approve the impeachment of President Trump. Some of them are saying they will look into it. I've seen Ben Sasse of Nebraska say he would look into voting yes for impeachment. But, you know, all of this takes some time. And we are now, you know, less than 2 weeks away from the inauguration of Joe Biden.
Rhonda Colvin is a reporter with The Washington Post. She reported on Wednesday, barricaded in a room at the Capitol. We do appreciate all that hard work. And thank you so much for finding some time to talk to us today. We really appreciate it, Rhonda.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me.
And up next, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown is among those calling for the 25th Amendment to be invoked. We'll hear about other Ohio leaders and their reaction to Wednesday's events when we check in with the State House News Bureau just ahead. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Following the violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, Senator Sherrod Brown, the Democrat of Ohio, is calling for the vice president and cabinet secretaries to remove President Trump from office. Governor Mike DeWine also focused on Trump and denouncing the mob that stormed the Congress. We'll talk about that and more now. We're joined via Zoom by Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporters Andy Chow and Joe Ingles. Hello, Andy.
Hey, Michael, how's it going?
It's going well. So glad you could be with us. And hello, Joe.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
So I spoke earlier this morning with Senator Sherrod Brown about his feelings on this matter. Let's hear a little bit of what he said.
I want to invoke the 25th Amendment so that his people, his cabinet, his vice president, who have been so loyal to the loyalty is often not reciprocal, but who have been so loyal, I want them to remove him, not for vengeance, not because I can say I told you so, not because I've never been a fan of this president, not even for the acts that he's committed this week, but remove him from the presidency because of what he might do. And we just can't envision what he might do to our national security, to our domestic safety. I've talked to friends who I trust who have overheard conversations from some of these rioters on airplanes and on buses saying they ain't seen nothing yet. Wait till we come back on January 20th with guns. So we need a president. I mean, I'm not a fan of Mike Pence's, but he believes he would not let, I would assume he would make sure that our nation's capital is protected and that there won't be riots and that people that are carrying guns illegally at the Capitol will be arrested.
Again, that was Senator Sherrod Brown, the Democrat of Ohio, speaking with me earlier this morning. We're talking with Andy Chow and Joe Ingles from the Ohio State House, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Andy, at the state level, you got reaction from Governor Mike DeWine to talk about and some other state leaders. Senator Brown is obviously part of the federal delegation. What are we hearing at the state level?
Yeah, so there was basically most every statewide official released some sort of statement reacting to the insurrection happening at the U.S. Capitol on Wednesday, starting with Governor Mike DeWine, who put out fairly strongly worded statement, especially when you consider the not so strongly worded statements in the past when it comes to President Donald Trump. And DeWine condemned the attacks, condemned the pro-Trump mob, called for an end to the violence. And that was pretty well echoed among the other Republican statewide office holders, Lieutenant Governor John Husted, Secretary of State Frank LaRose, of course, Ohio's elections chief, talked about the sanctity of elections. Attorney General Dave Yost talked about how it's important to seek criminal prosecution of anybody who committed crimes at the U.S. Capitol. So pretty robust collection of statewide leaders voicing their condemnation of the attacks. But then you have Ohio House Minority Leader Amelia Sykes. She's the leader of the House Democrats, also condemning the attacks, but also sort of chiding the Republican leaders in Ohio for enabling this kind of behavior, almost being complicit in what Donald Trump has done over the past 4 years building up to this point because of their support of him, because of their defense of him over the years.
And we'll note that U.S. Attorney David DeVillers here in our area says federal crimes were committed at our nation's Capitol building. Anyone who traveled from the Southern District of Ohio with the intent to commit such crimes will be prosecuted in the Southern District of Ohio. So it does seem like the events are being taken very seriously, even far away from the steps of the Capitol or the inside of the Capitol where all this violence and tragedy took place. But meanwhile, of course, there is still state business to deal with. And there was a piece of legislation that drew some sharp criticism. It was signed into law by Ohio Governor Mike DeWine. Joe, it's called Stand Your Ground for Our Sake. Remind us briefly what that is and then what the story about it is.
Well, basically, there was in Ohio law previously, there's been a duty to retreat. So in other words, you really have to try to get out of the situation first before you can fire a weapon legally. This stand your ground allows you to stand your ground. You don't have to retreat. And it's been used in other states. I think there's 30 some states that have stand your ground, some version of it. And Ohio has not, but they have fought, the advocates for this bill have fought for a long time to get it. And the real question was, would Governor Mike DeWine sign it? Because, you know, he has his own gun reform plan, and it really focuses on reining in gun violence in a variety of ways. There's a lot of steps in it, but it involves reporting and trying to get guns out of the hands of criminals, that sort of thing. And the legislature has done nothing with his plan. So the question is, would he sign it? And he did. Of course, gun rights supporters were thrilled. But then, a lot of the people who have been fighting against gun violence, they were first of all kind of surprised that he signed it, given that he's taken another direction with his own legislation. And then secondly, they question, will this make Ohio, which already has issues, we already have protests and outcries about violence against minorities especially, will this make it more likely that those situations can happen legally under the law? And one thing, Mike, I think we need to note is that Governor DeWine signed this the day or 2 days before, it was right before the unrest that we saw in D.C. That's important to note.
Of course. And I just want to note that Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley, who recently announced she would not be seeking re-election for mayor, she has this complicated relationship with the governor, right? She's a Democrat. Mm-hmm. He's a Republican. But they came together pretty closely following that deadly tragedy, the mass shooting that killed 9 people in downtown Dayton back in 2019. But mm-hmm. she's not a fan of the Stand Your Ground bill. And I'm wondering what her reaction was.
She was really upset with Governor DeWine for signing this. She says that, this is, she wants to continue the fight to try to, have more gun control in the state. But she says Governor DeWine was wrong in signing it, and she's outraged.
I know that Governor DeWine is, has even caught the attention of Donald Trump back in November when the president tweeted, quote, "Who will be running for governor of the great state of Ohio will be hotly contested." We're still a little bit away from any type of gubernatorial election. But I mean, are we hearing any rumblings in the state capitol or around the state about what that campaign might end up looking like? I guess I would toss that to either Andy or Joe.
Yeah, I mean, we have heard that, you know, some people, especially when you look at Jim Renacci, former Congressman Jim Renacci, he's kind of back on the radar with his social media and such. And he's been talked about as a potential candidate to run against Governor DeWine. We've also heard some people saying, well, Jim Jordan, the congressman from Northwest Ohio, might be a possibility. But there's nothing formal at this point. And to be quite honest, the events of this week have kind of overshadowed all the political posturing a bit. So
it is interesting, though, Michael, because although Joe's exactly right, there were sort of, this was going to be a week where candidates were sort of going to position themselves to possibly primary. Mike DeWine, Jim Renacci held a town hall meeting yesterday to talk about the state's future. And although the events and the insurrection has overshadowed it, it has played a role, or people have claimed that it's playing a role in all of the reactions. So when you even have people asking Governor DeWine yesterday more about his criticism of Trump, and they even asked him, would you support somebody like President Donald Trump if he were to run for office again? And Mike DeWine, even though he said that Trump poured gasoline on the fire of the insurrection, he wouldn't commit to not supporting Trump if he were to run for office again.
Well, we should note that gun rights is one of those issues that can be difficult for what might be described as a moderate mainstream Republican. If you're trying to work with a Democrat mayor on some sort of acceptable reforms in the eyes of Republican voters, while also not going too far, not to turn off some of these people who might primary you from the right. So it will be quite a balancing act for the incumbent governor to perform. And we'll continue to watch and check in with you all as that proceeds. However, there is a sort of election that's emerging anyway, and that involves a local politician, or at least former local politician. That's David Pepper, who has stepped down as the Ohio Democratic Party chair. And now there are people trying to step up to take his place. Joe, what can you tell us about the people who want to represent this party? It was not a great election cycle for Democrats.
No, that's putting it mildly. There was, we had some little victories locally that we saw the Democrats take those. We saw the Democrats take the Supreme Court seat that used to belong to Republican Supreme Court Justice Judith French. It's now Jennifer Bruner, former Secretary of State. She has been sworn in Supreme Court Justice for the Democrats. But when we look back at all of the outcomes of the election, it was clear that the Democrats, once again, didn't make the traction and the headway that they wanted to. David Niven, who is from the University of Cincinnati, political science professor, he told me the problem with Ohio for Democrats is that it's whiter and it's older and it's less educated than the rest of the country, and that it's going to be that way for a while, and that Democrats are going to have to find a unique way to get in there and deal with that. So right now we have six different Democrats who are vying for David Pepper's seat. They're all basically people who have had some sort of background in politics, Democratic politics. And next Thursday, the 14th of January, the executive committee will vote on who to put into that slot.
You can read about those candidates at statenews.org, along with a lot of other great coverage of what's happening in the state capitol and around the state. Before I let you all run, let's talk a little bit about COVID-19 and the vaccines, like the 2020 election that's still bleeding into this year. Obviously, this pandemic is ongoing as well. How is the vaccine rollout going in the state right now, Andy?
You have plenty of people who would say that it's not going very well, that the rate of distribution, meaning how many people are actually getting vaccinated compared to how much vaccine the state has in Ohio right now, is pretty low. The state is trying to ramp that up. You have group 1A right now, which are mostly just healthcare workers who are on the front lines of this getting the vaccine, as well as people living in congregate care settings like nursing homes. And then the state is trying to work towards widening the population to group 1B. That'll be people over the age of 65, people with serious health conditions, and teachers and staff at K through 12 schools. And the problem there is that DeWine says the challenge is that the state's only going to be getting about 100,000 doses of the vaccine per week for the next couple of weeks to deal with that group 1B unless something changes. And so it sounds like there are several challenges trickling down from the federal level to the state level, and then challenges infrastructure-wise getting the vaccine out to different places in different regions of Ohio.
And obviously this is important because a certain percentage of us, and we've heard different numbers, but I mean, at least 70% is what seems to be a pretty consistent number, need to be vaccinated for us to reach that coveted herd immunity so that we can get back to some sense of normalcy in this country. And Joe, I believe the police have weighed in this week on COVID vaccines.
They have. The police union, the head, Gary Wolski, says that basically when it first came out, the news of who was going to get vaccines when, they talked about first responders. And of course, the police thought, well, we're first responders. We'll be among the first. When they rolled out the 1A group, police were not in that 1A group. And now in the 1B group, police say they've been put behind the teachers. And, you know, this is something that they don't have any problem with teachers or school employees getting the vaccines, they say. But they say the problem is that they are out in the public in an even more dangerous situation than teachers. And that they are often dealing with people who are, you know, COVID positive and in very close contact and in dangerous ways. One thing that was brought up to me was that a police officer who is working as a school resource officer is going to get the vaccine before the rank and file police officers because they work inside a school. And so the police union is trying to fight to get up higher on that list.
Andy Chow and Joe Ingles are with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. You can read their reporting at statenews.org and hear their reporting here on 91.7 WVXU. Andy, Joe, Happy New Year. Thanks for taking some time to talk to us again. Always appreciate it.
Happy New Year to you, too.
All right. And you're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU, where local research reveals some dangers about what had been called a miracle anti-COVID drug, remdesivir. I spoke earlier with WVXU reporter and midday host Ann Thompson about it. Ann Thompson, thanks for making some time for Cincinnati Edition today.
Thanks, Michael.
Well, let's talk about remdesivir. I understand this was referred to by some as a, quote, miracle drug for people suffering particularly bad symptoms from COVID-19. But there's this new research coming from the University of Cincinnati, a pharmaceutical scientist there. What's it telling us about remdesivir?
So Binfong Yen studies how drugs are metabolized. That's what he does. He's a pharmaceutical scientist at the University of Cincinnati. And he and some of his graduate students looked at remdesivir, this drug used to treat COVID, as you mentioned, by some called a miracle drug. And he doesn't dispute the fact that it does work. It does inhibit replication of the coronavirus. But his concern comes with the fact that remdesivir, also known now as Veklury, it stops the activity of an enzyme, CES2, he says, which is found in the intestine, liver, and kidneys. And you might think, like, okay, well, why is that important? Well, this enzyme is needed for the breakdown of many medications. So if you're on some kind of heart medication or anti-cancer drug or AIDS drug, hepatitis C, this, if you take remdesivir, your other drugs may not work anymore. And in fact, they might be toxic or they might not work as well as they once did.
So to be clear, we're talking about if you're taking remdesivir and you're taking certain other medications, that there could be some complications or it could even negate the positive impacts of those other medications?
That's exactly right. And in addition to that, he says, remdesivir also needs CES too. So if it's damaging that, it may not work in some people. And I tried to find out exactly like what drugs are involved, but apparently there are too many to name. And the best thing to do, he says, is to just talk to your doctor. So remdesivir is given, I believe, over a 10-day period only in the hospital intravenously. So before you get it, you or your relatives need to tell the doctor, okay, I have these other medications that I need to take, and what is this going to do? I mean, I guess it depends on your situation. If you're very critically ill, you know, and you need to take remdesivir, then you'll deal with the consequences later. But he does have concerns. And in fact, he says that the World Health Organization brought up some of the concerns and said that more study is needed. It was granted last year emergency use authorization from the FDA. So anyway, he's just saying, look, more study is needed, but really, you know, it shouldn't just be used indiscriminately.
And to be clear, he's talking about antiviral drugs as well, as you're mentioning. We're talking about people who yes. might have HIV/AIDS or hepatitis C that could be a particular risk for this.
Yes, that it does include that too. Thanks for bringing that up. So, right, there are some concerns, and he, you know, just wants to make sure that people know this.
And like you noted, the FDA here in America gave Veklury this emergency use, this remdesivir, but internationally, a little more caution about more study was issued.
That's correct. Yes. So he's, you know, and he admits that, like, look, I need to do, you know, more study, but wanted to get his findings out there. His findings were published in Fundamental and Clinical Pharmacy publication.
Ann Thompson is a reporter here at WVXU. You also hear her middays. Ann, thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Michael. You too.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We finish up the weekly news review with the sports page. Joining us now on the phone is Fox Sports Radio host Andy Furman. Andy, welcome back.
Happy New Year, belated Happy New Year to you, and I guess I'm last, but that's a good thing to be last. I mean, everybody comes to the end, the crescendo of the Cincinnati edition.
It is the crescendo, and I'm wondering, because I said Happy New Year to our previous guest just moments ago, it is the 8th of January. How big of a window do we have where we can say Happy New Year still?
Well, I think you could say it, Happy New Year, all year long, but it's going to be a Happy New Year, I hope. But today there was some sad news in the world of sports. Tommy Lasorda passed away, 93 years of age, Hall of Fame manager for the Los Angeles Dodgers. And I had a feeling something was wrong, because the other day they said they released him from the hospital. I knew he was still ill, but the point is that when you release somebody, they knew they want to be with their family when they pass, and I think that's what happened.
That is a tragedy. A lot of us know him. He was one of those characters who crossed over from the sports world into popular culture, I think, as a kid. I remember him. Was it Slim Fast? Was he a spokesperson
yes.
for Slim Fast?
I got a funny story about Tommy Lasorda. He came to Cincinnati after he managed the Dodgers to do some sort of charity work at a Catholic institution, and I was able to interview him in the dugout prior to a Reds game on WLW when I was working over there doing sports talk, and we talked, and he came out, and after the interview he says to me, well, what do I get? And I thought he was joking. I said, what do you mean, what do you get? He says, don't I get a gift for being a guest on your show? I said, well, not really. And he bugged me, and when he went back to L.A., he called me. So I said, okay, what do you want? So he said he wanted a camera. So I got a camera, I purchased a camera, and I handed the receipt into the radio station, and they refused, they wouldn't give me the money back. So I got burnt. So I sent Tommy Lasorda a camera. He wanted a camera, unbelievable.
Oh my gosh, that's a brilliant story. I can't believe you got scammed by Tommy Lasorda.
I know it, right? But I've been scamming everybody since.
Well, good for you. Well, let's talk about sports. And the Bengals, I think people have some negative feelings about the Bengals, to say the least. And we're going to talk about the head coaching situation. Zach Taylor, he's been here two seasons now. He's won 6 games, lost 25 of them, but the Bengals are sticking with him for next season. Is that the right move?
You know what, though? Not only is it the right move, I think it's an ingenious move, and let me explain why. Economically, it's a great move, because he signed a 5-year deal, and I don't care what business you're in. People will point fingers, obviously, to Mike Brown, but he's no different than anybody else in business. You don't want to pay somebody not to work, and that's basically what they would do if they got rid of him. That's number one. Number two, a new head coach would come in here and would demand a new staff, which would never happen here in Cincinnati. And number three, which is probably the best of the entire lot here, is the fact that this him coming back, Zach Taylor coming back, puts entirely more pressure on Zach Taylor to win. If they don't make the playoffs next year, then he should be gone. really, because now the fact that he's been given another life, and he probably in the back of his mind probably thought that there's a good chance he may not come back. Well, now he's been given another chance. Now he better win. And obviously with Joe Burrow coming back, and Burrow announced yesterday that he thinks he'll be ready for the first game, now the pressure and the seat is hot as the season begins for Zach Taylor.
And Joe Burrow, obviously the first round, the first overall pick in the draft ahead of last season, suffered a serious injury and missed the last part of the season. What can we expect from these guys next season? We know that because of their poor record, they'll get a pretty favorable draft pick again. And, you know, what can we expect when they return to the field?
Well, what I expect is some more beef on that offensive line and some more offensive performance, because I think last year they went the defensive route and they got some defensive picks in the draft. But obviously right now you don't know if A.J. Green's going to come back or not. But they got a pretty good nucleus on the offensive side with a healthy Joe Burrow, Tyler Boyd at receiver. T. Higgins is a tremendous receiver, have a great future here. So we'll see what happens over there. And obviously Giovanni Bernard came to life as well. So you got to see what's going to happen next year on the offensive side of the ball, if they could do something. And it's not only the draft. They got to go out there in free agency and get some proven players. You're going to draft an offensive lineman out of college who's never had NFL experience. I don't think that even compares to a guy who is a free agent who has had play in the NFL.
Well, let's talk about a couple of people that are no longer part of the Bengals organization, but still have a lot of fans, or maybe the opposite of fans in our area, Marvin Lewis and Andy Dalton, who were part of that rise to solid mediocrity. And Marvin Lewis might get another shot at a head coaching job, it looks like.
And I think he should. I mean, the overall body of work that he did here in Cincinnati, he changed the culture, and I hate that word, but he certainly did change the culture in that clubhouse, and he made the playoffs for 5 consecutive years. He was interviewed yesterday with the New York Jets. I certainly hope he doesn't go there, because I think in New York, it's a fishbowl of media, and he may get destroyed over there. And as soon as he gets hired, there'll be a lot of naysayers saying, why did he get the job? There's a good opportunity. I think he was interviewed in Detroit, and I think he's going to get that job with the Detroit Lions. It's really, that team's been flat on its back for years, and the only way he can go is up. So I think that's a good move if he gets that Detroit job, which I think he will.
Well, we'll keep an eye out on that. What about Andy Dalton? He had a pretty decent appearance as the backup quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys this season. Looks like he's set to become a free agent. Where does he land? He's still got some good years left.
Well, I think Dallas got a good deal with him, because certainly their main guy went down, and Andy Dalton, he gave him some good play. He really did, and it wasn't expensive. I think the name of the game right now is money, and certainly he wasn't getting a lot of money, and that's one of the reasons why the New England Patriots signed Cam Newton. It's like, for $7 million, that's almost a steal in the NFL. I don't think Newton will be back, but again, an experienced quarterback, maybe the New England Patriots will be looking in that direction. Who knows? But the rumors have it that Matt Stafford may be leaving Detroit, and he may be going to New England. So we'll see what happens. I think there'll definitely be a job in the National Football League, not maybe as a starter for Andy Dalton, but certainly a quality backup is needed. As you saw this year, so many of those frontline quarterbacks have gone down.
Well, let's turn to basketball now. I know it's, I don't know if it's hard to believe or easy to believe that it's been almost a year since we first started talking about the coronavirus, but it was March of last year when it first arrived here in America. And I was watching the Northern Kentucky basketball game. I went to Indianapolis to watch the Horizon League tournament, where they won and won an automatic bid to the NCAA tournament. And it was even at that event where you started to see more hand sanitizer out, but there were no restrictions on crowds yet. And then the whole NCAA tournament was canceled. And it looks like
it was March 11th, to be exact.
Yeah. So it looks like they're going to try to put the tournament on this year in sort of a bubble situation, where they keep everybody together and keep it all in one city, in Indianapolis. Do you think this is going to work out?
You know, certainly as a fan, I not only hope it works out, I really pray it works out. And selfishly, I say I want to see it, because I love college basketball, I love sports, and certainly in these times during the pandemic, you want something to do. On the other side of the coin, and the logical side of me, which I even sometimes doubt I have that, but the logical side of me says, look, you're doing it for one reason and one reason only. You're doing it for the money. You know, they talk about watching out for the student athletes. I mean, there was a game the other day, I think it was last night, UCLA was playing, and there was a talk prior to the game that they had 8 guys not available. They may not even play the game. They played last night, and they won in overtime. But the point is that it's all about the money. And look, if they really truly cared about these student athletes, A, They would have women's field hockey. They would have soccer. They'd have track and field. They'd have every other sport. But no, they have basketball and football. Why? Those are the money cows. That's why they're playing these games. It's all about the money. That's why they're doing it. Am I happy? Yeah, I'm happy. I'm happy that they're playing. Would I be happy if my son was playing on those basketball teams? Not really. I'd be concerned. I really would be.
Well, they'll be doing it at six different stadiums: Lucas Oil Stadium, Bankers Life Fieldhouse, Hinkle Fieldhouse, Indiana Farmers Coliseum, Simon Scott Assembly Hall. I'm sure I mispronounced that, and Mackey Arena. So it's going to be interesting to see how that works out, and hopefully everyone is safe, and hopefully we see some local teams making an appearance there. Let's talk about the local teams and their current status. It's probably been a long time, Andy, since both the Cincinnati Bearcats and the Kentucky Wildcats find themselves sub 500.
Wow. I mean, I watched that UC game last night. They had a sweat to beat SMU. SMU is a good team. But UCLA, they're coming together. You know, sloppy play, a lot of turnovers, not much on the offensive rebounding. But I think eventually they'll come around. But I think they're digging themselves a hole that they may not be able to represent the American Athletic Conference. But we'll see what happens in the playoffs. Kentucky, I'm shocked. I'm really shocked. Maybe it's finally caught up with them, the one and dones. I mean, they just can't reload as they've done in the past. I mean, they're just not doing it. I don't get it. But the good news is Xavier, they had a real big win over St. John's the other day. And Xavier's going to be competing in the Big East, which is great.
9-2 overall is Xavier. We're also, obviously, very selfishly, I keep an eye on the Northern Kentucky Norse. Not looking so bad so far, but some tough teams in the Horizon League this year.
Right. Certainly tough teams there, and the right states are tough. But, you know, it's funny, you talked about last year's tournament. I think the team that really, really got the kick in the groin was the University of Dayton. I mean, it was a shock.
Yeah,
Dayton could have gone to the Final Four, and they cut it short. And, you know, a school like Dayton, you really want to see someone like that go further. It may not be for a while, if at all, that you'll see Dayton making a run at the Final Four. So to them, it was a real shame that it was cut short.
What else are we looking for in the world of sports in the days ahead, Andy Furman?
Well, you know, we got the playoffs this weekend, which is going to be great. I mean, you got something like seven games in 3 days. So if the weather's poor, you stay indoors and watch football. The national championship is Monday. You got Alabama and Ohio State, and everybody's talking about Alabama. But you know what? For my money, I like Ohio State. Maybe I'm crazy. Maybe I'm a homer, whatever you want to call it, because I live near the Buckeye State. I live in the Commonwealth for sure. But I like Ohio State. I like their line play. I like the quarterback play. I like the way they turned it around against Clemson. I think that Ohio State could take them, and I hope they do take them. I think it's good for college football, because this dominance of Alabama, you know, certainly they may be the most dominant football team in college history. I don't think it's healthy for the sport, for college football.
It does get a little tiresome. I have to tell you, I don't scare easily, you know, working in the news business. But Nick Saban, the head coach at Alabama, I watch him on TV. I don't know what it is about him. He terrifies me. I would run from that man.
He's a funny guy. I mean, they say one-on-one, and I've never met him, but one-on-one, he's humorous and he's funny, and he's doing Aflac commercials now, which is,
he's funny in those commercials, so
right,
I don't get that
at all.
There must be a soft side to him, but there's no way I would run all the laps. I would run every lap he tells me to. We got 30 seconds left, Andy, and in a condensed form, I just want you to tell us, what have you learned about sports and its importance in our culture during this very strange period?
Well, certainly, I think if you go back in history, you know what happened during World War II. FDR was the president, and told them baseball being canceled. So, we need a diversion, and certainly they had a diversion. So sports certainly proves to be a great diversion from our daily doldrums and our daily pandemic when you don't even know one day from another. So I think it's great to have sports.
Fox Sports Radio host Andy Furman once scammed into buying a camera for the great late Tommy Lasorda. Thanks for spending some time. Hey, buddy, if you come across any cameras, I could always use one.
All right. God bless you, Michael.
See you, Andy. Happy New Year. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. This theme music was composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. Have a great weekend. We'll talk again on Monday.